Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip, and this is episode number 29. We're smashing through them. I've got to say straight off the bat, it's a relief to be out of March Madness. That was kind of mad. It's very enjoyable. It was great to get. I mean, who did we get in that March Madness? We've got Frank Turner, Billy Bragg, Dylan Moran, myself doing a Q&A with you guys. Rob DeBank, Wes Borland, Reynolds, and Sarah Pascoe. So that was amazing. But this week's guest, you know, after doing 2 a week, I had to have someone really exciting. And this week's guest, I'm hugely excited for. It's Mr. Paddy Considine. Before we get into that, though, I'm going to quickly give a shout out to Speech Development Records. That is my record label. If you go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com, look at my stutter going crazy now. It's because I nailed the Dylan Moran earlier. That'll make sense if you've listened to that podcast. If you go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com, we've got t-shirts, we've got barbecue aprons, we've got mugs, we've got hats, we've got jackets, jumpers, all sorts of stuff. We've got live DVDs and all sorts. So go there, and everything you buy there kind of helps support the podcast. But I want to quickly, this week, give a specific shout and ask you to, if you've not already aware of him, take a look at Mr. B. Dolan. I'm releasing his album on the label this year on Speech Development Records. He's a close friend of mine. I've loved him for a long time. I've been a fan and a friend for a long time. He's toured with us, supported us, so a lot of you will already be aware of him. But he's on Strange Famous Records in America, and I'm luckily being able to work with them to release his album in the UK. But he's just got a lot of stuff that you will enjoy, I think. And I think people need to be more aware of him even before this next album drops, because it's his best work to date. But there's stuff, I mean, I'd recommend you go and check out Which Side Are You On, for example. It's on YouTube. You can check it out for free, because that's really good. Obviously, in this week's podcast with Paddy, we talk about his film Pride, and how important the gay rights movement was during the miners' strike. Which Side Are You On addresses the homophobia displayed at times in hip-hop, and the misogyny and all sorts. So, yeah, he's definitely worth checking out. That's B. Dolan. Go and look him up on YouTube. B, then D-O-L-A-N. Check him out. But, yeah, anyway, back to today's podcast. It's Mr. Paddy Considine. I was so excited to get to sit down with Paddy. He's as you will hear shortly, he's one of my favourite actors. I've seen a lot of his work. I'm quite knowledgeable on his body of work. But I mean, equally, he's just the nicest of guys. I've met him a couple of times before this, and he was so friendly, and he'd expressed that he listens to the podcast and enjoys it. So yeah, it was great to get to sit down and chat to him. So without further ado, let's get into that. This is Distraction Pieces podcast number 29 with Mr. Paddy Considine. And that's it. That was our big start. That me pressing play there was how I indicate the beginning of the podcast. I'm here with Paddy Considine. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing all right, Pip. I'm not bad these days.
It's lovely to have you. Thank you for coming on. Is this a rare trip into London these days, or...?
No, I'm here quite a bit, really.
Regularly?
Yeah, I travel in a lot, and for the last few years, I've always seemed to work here at some point of the year, so... I get to live in a different part of it every time I do a film, and I love London.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah,
you know, it's one of those cities that I'm still kind of discovering things, you know, after years of working down here.
I think the key for that can be not moving here, essentially, because I live in Essex and I still love London, but I feel if I lived here, it'd be too much for me, and I'd be sick of it. But the fact of living outside of it, you get to come in, appreciate it,
and go
and then
home.
Step away. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And visit it and enjoy it. So yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely that. I don't know if I could live here.
Yeah.
You know, with a young family and that, but you know, people do. It's great. But I love working here. I love coming down here.
Yeah. Was it? Or was London a big part at the start to kind of? I mean, like, how did you start getting into acting and getting into film initially?
Initially, oh God. Well,
where did you grow up?
There's a long version of this and a shorter one, but I'm from a town called Burton-on-Trent in the Midlands, and that's where I grew up. And I always had aspirations about making films and being involved in films in some way, but I didn't know how.
Yeah.
I kind of lived at the cinema, really.
Yeah.
There was an Odeon down on Guild Street, and it was 99 pence to watch a film, you know, in the
80s.
So we kind of, me and a small group of friends had lived there. I never became a filmo, you know, film buff or anything, but I just enjoyed movies.
Yeah, completely. I think this... for me, it's been in recent years I've become re-addicted to and appreciative of the experience of the cinema. I think the cinema is such a thing, and I think it doesn't always have to be the best film in the world. It's the whole experience of it. As long as it's a good and entertaining film, I think the cinema is a great and essential experience, far better than just watching a DVD or watching on your laptop or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. It still holds your attention.
Yeah.
And you have to be kind of careful. It's that you don't kind of... I think at some points in over the last 10 years or so, since I started acting, at times I've got quite cynical about cinema and even about, you know, even about acting and stuff like that. But ultimately, what keeps me in there is this, that initial kind of love and the need to sort of to tell stories. I think if anything, the reason why I would do it, why I do it, was the need to tell stories in some way. When I was a kid, it was about showing off. I mean, going back to kind of growing up, I was kind of quite a disruptive kid at school and that, you know, never kind of destructively so, but my mind was always elsewhere anyway. Yeah. It was never in the moment as a little kid. But I suppose when I started to do a few performances at school, it was just because I kind of wanted people to see me, and not see me as in, you know, jazz hands and all that, I want everyone to look at me. It wasn't that. It was just I thought I want people to see me. I'd been kind of quite brutal to some teachers, you know, and given them a hard time in my younger part of school and senior school, and I just felt that I'd become a kind of waste of time.
Right.
And the general consensus amongst those teachers was like, they were giving up on me. It's like, you're a talented kid, but you're just going to throw everything away being the clown.
Yeah.
And a teacher said something to me in my third year, and I was like cracking jokes and disrupting the class. And he said, you know, it's all right now, Constantine, everyone's laughing. He said, but one day you won't have your audience.
Yeah.
And I kind of like, I understood what he meant even then.
I thought, definitely.
I didn't defiantly become an actor and go, well, now I've got an audience, so up yours. It was like, yeah, do I want to become the clown of the building site? Is that what I want to be?
Yeah.
Do I want to be the funniest guy in the factory, or do I want to go and do something? So I started doing odd plays at school, and I started to get attention, but it was the right attention. I felt that people started to believe in me a little bit. And I'd grown up with certain kids that... you know, we came from kind of broken families in a way. And some were one parent, some were both parents, but they were still broken families.
Yeah.
And I just sort of had this sense in me that I was always gonna move on. I was always gonna move away. And I had a teacher at school called Margaret Balderson who put me into this drama group, and I was terrified because it was full of kids from all different walks of life. They were mainly kind of middle class kids, if I'm honest.
Right,
And I was quite terrified about going into that. And I went in there and just found a bunch of really lovely kids, you know, who I got on perfectly well with. And in my first kind of term there, I was cast in Gregory's Girl, the play of Gregory's Girl. And she announced who was playing who, and it's Paddy, you're Gregory. And I didn't go back for 2 weeks.
Right.
And I can remember standing on the hill in Winsall. It kind of stands above the town of Burton. And from the top of the hill, you can see the roof of my school, which is where the acting classes sort of took place.
Yeah.
Around there, acting classes. It was a youth drama group thing. And I remember standing with my group of friends and looking at the roof of this thing and knowing that at that time that class was going on. And I looked at the friends around me and just silently to myself said goodbye to them.
Right.
You know, it was time to
wow.
to say goodbye, and I felt it then. And I went to the class the following week, and it was like, where have you been? You haven't been for 2 weeks. And I made my bullshit excuses. But ultimately, I said to the teacher, I think her name was Jane, I said to her, when I gave her my excuse, she said to me, rather, if you hadn't come this week, you'd have been out. That'd have been it, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't really become a stage schooly kid. I left school, I went on a drama course, and it didn't work. I hated it, really. I became really self-conscious. The joy seemed to be sapped out of it from me. And maybe it was because the course was such a young course, but it was just felt very cruel.
Yeah, I think a lot of those things can seem so harsh. Like anything that's teaching arts as such, it's such a fine line, because there's not necessarily, I'm sure there are rights and wrongs, but it's not as simple as that. I always remember when I was trying to learn to write scripts and screenplays, and in fact our mutual friend Kelly Marcel advised me. She said, don't read any of them screenwriting books. I think read scripts that you like.
Read
stuff that you think is good, and that's how you learn, rather than saying, here's the formula, here's what you have to do, X, Y, Z, and it works. Because it's not always as formulaic as that. And I'd imagine with a lot of acting schools and things like that as well, it can be quite, they're doing this every year, they're doing the same, teaching the same structures and approach, which isn't necessarily always going to ignite everyone in the same way.
Yeah, but also I remember it's all of that. And also I remember being in a movement class once. But, you know, and it was all fun. But and there were some lovely kids on the course. We're talking about, we were kids, we were 17. But I remember the teacher asked me to be a car engine.
Right.
Pretend you're a car engine. And I said, why? And she says, because I told you to. And I went, what does that mean? You told me to, you know, why? And her reply to that was, get out.
Wow.
So I was sent out of the class for asking.
Questioning.
And there wasn't one part of it that said, listen, if you want to be an actor, you may be asked to do some really stupid shit.
That makes
you feel self-conscious and embarrassed, and you've got to kind of get over that hurdle a little bit to commit. There was none of that. It was just, because I told you to.
Yeah.
You don't want to do it, get out. And that was one of many things.
That's not
things.
Enough of a...
Not really, no.
...explanational lesson there, is it really?
Yeah, and I wasn't ready to learn anything, I suppose, when I look back. It was like something wasn't sitting with me. I thought, if this is acting, and I'm not interested. You know, this is doing nothing for me. And it was a really strange time in my life. But around that time, I met Shane Meadows.
Yep.
He was the year above us, but he'd been held back because he'd been in an accident. He got kind of run off his bike, scooter, I think. A car had caught him, and he damaged his leg badly, and it put him a year back. So we ended up in he ended up in our class. And Shane, when he was in his 20s, looked about 40. You know, he looked like a bloke compared to us. You know, we looked like, but we were young kids, but Shane looked 10 years older than. He looked like our dad, you know, if we went to town.
Amazing.
And that was a really big thing for me, meeting him, because it was we kind of skirted around each other for the first few weeks of term. You know, there was a bit of wariness there, like, who's this guy?
Yeah.
Who's this old guy? But we, you know, we kind of, something bonded us. I think we got stuck together and painted each other's teeth black, and that was the thing that kind of made us...
Amazing.
...broke down the barriers somehow. Yeah. But then we became a little bit kind of... inseparable for a while. But Shane was really, really important, because I felt like I'd grown up with a head of ideas and imagery and things, but had no idea how to execute any of those things.
Yeah, completely. You know? I think it's really interesting that at the start you said you always felt you wanted to be in films in some way, whether that be acting or writing. And I think that can be, that can stop you at points. If you don't have that clear, I want to be an actor, or I just want to be involved in this. I love this in every element. I want to do all parts of it. That can, in a way, unless you get that right moment or meet those right people, it can hold you back because you've not got enough of a specific goal. But it can also be a great thing when you meet those other people who are like, right.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's okay. All about who you... I think it's all about how you ignite and who you kind of, you know, bump into on your way along on this ride, and Shane was one of those. He, like, lit the touch paper, if you like.
Yeah.
He had this kind of thing in him where He made the world feel small, whereas I would look at the kind of horizon and think, how do I get out of this fucking place?
Yeah.
And I'm meaning the town, but not the town itself. I still live there, but really it was like, how do I get out of this place in my head?
Yeah, sure.
How do
sure.
I kind of move? And Shane just made everything seem possible. That was the first thing. We formed a band, and it was like we were sat around one day, and Shane said, like, let's make a band. I'm the singer, you know. Yeah. We're like, all right, you're the singer. And it's like, you can play bass, Rich, because you and Simon, your guitar, we'll get Nick. What about you, Paddy? I'll be drums. I'd never played any drums. And then the next day, a drum kit turned up. Just turned up.
Amazing.
From a, you know, so these odd... And then 6 weeks later, we were in a studio recording. You know, and it was like, he had that go in him. And that was infectious to me.
Yeah,
and
that's such a motivational thing, the fact of not just sitting around and talking about these things, going, right, let's do this.
Yeah.
Rather than spending a week planning it or imagining it, go, let's just do it and see what happens.
Yeah, we're in a studio, and it was amazing to me, because I was like, I remember seeing a documentary on the Sex Pistols and Steve Jones talking about Brian Ferry and Bowie and saying, I thought these people literally fell from the sky.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I could understand that completely. It was like, yeah, these people are obviously really special and they get anointed somehow.
Yeah.
And they are who they are. And, you know, I didn't realise that a kid like me could manoeuvre this way, you know?
It's one of the things I think is key of making sure that live venues and live music doesn't die out. Because that 90% of the time, particularly with punk bands and things like that, that's when you stand there and go, I could do this, like, not in an arrogant way.
Absolutely, this is possible.
Whereas when it is that separate thing and it's in a magazine or something else, it's unimaginable, it's unattainable. Whereas when it's some bloke stood there in front of you, it's like, wow, that's a real thing. The first a song I put out, and the first one that got any attention had a section in it where I listed a load of bands and said, just a band. And a lot of people thought that was in some way an insult. It wasn't. It came from that exact thing of thinking of, at that point I chose, it was Radiohead specifically I thought of, because it was around Christmas and I thought, like, a Radiohead, they're the most amazing thing. But at this point, Tom York is probably having to pass the potatoes to his brother and his mum's telling them to have some more veg. And they're just regular people. And that's what the whole section was about. It wasn't about insulting anyone. Yeah. It was saying, you realise that these at some point, they were you who were sitting there going, I'd like to start a band, but I'm not sure. And again, the same with acting, I guess, and all of those things. It's like, I'd like to do that. Then, all right, well, let's do it then.
Yeah.
So where did it go from there? I know from the studio with Shane.
Well, you know, well, I ended up leaving college after a year, and it was around that time, in 91, that I met my wife, and that was obviously a massive thing because we're together 25 years later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the thing for that was that I'd hit a really bad point in my life, and I was kind of directionless. I'd been on the dole for a year, and at that time she'd gone through college and completed her course, and in that short space of time, I realised that, you know, I'd never finished anything.
Yeah.
You know, and she'd just gone through and done this course and she was off to university. And I was still back in Burton. But one thing, I just thought, actually, it's not that hard. It always felt like a marathon to me doing stuff like that. Like, I thought school was like a prison. I actually looked at it like being in the nick.
And
going, oh, a bit of bird. Yeah, I've only got 3 years left.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember having those thoughts.
Yeah.
And thinking of it like that, I'll be free in 2 years. But I saw her complete it now, and that's all it takes, is just commitment. It's just a few months. And so I went back to college. Shane had gone off to Nottingham College. I went back to college, and for the first, you couldn't get away with this nowadays, but for the first sort of 6 weeks, I'd just get on a bus, go to college. I had a box with pastels in and other things. And I would go into classes and draw fruit. I'd go and sculpt clay and stuff like that. Yeah. And it was my safe place, my haven that I went to every day. And after a term, one of the guys there, one of the lecturers who kind of we knew before, he ended up being in 24/7 and Romeo Brass.
Oh, wow.
Colin Higgins, he looked at me one day and he went, what course are you actually on? And I just thought, oh shit, it's over. You know, he's caught me. I can't.
Yeah.
I can't. I was kind of pretending to be a student or something.
Just turning up and just do it.
And he went, and I just thought, I said, I'm not on any course, Colin. I'm not on one. And I thought, I'm out. And he went, come on then, let's go and get you enrolled on photography and film.
Amazing.
And it was as simple as that. You know, I went up, he enrolled me, and then I was at college, and then I was doing photography.
Again, the instant difference there between a teacher saying, you've got to be an engine because I've told you to, and, you know, you equally could have got that kind of teacher who said, what course are you on? Right, get out.
Yeah.
Instead of going, right, realising he's not on a course, but he's here every fucking day. Yeah. You know, he obviously wants to do something.
Commitment.
Let's do something. So, yeah. So then you went on to photography and
yeah,
and
I did photography
it.
And that was great. I mean, I was really, I love boxing. So I started to kind of photograph fighters and I learnt my craft at the Burton Boxing Club. A lot of failures, a lot of things not coming out on film, a lot of things badly lit. And,
yeah.
But I remember pulling out one roll of film and the image was on there, and it was after my sixth attempt. I was so bad at photography, and I was there was an image on there, and I was like, wow, and it blew my mind.
It's there. And then, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the beauty, I did photography at Wolverhampton University, and just the beauty of having of them opening the doors and you having access to dark rooms, to all their equipment and stuff like that, and coming from a family where I couldn't afford expensive cameras and any of that kind of thing, it's something that you couldn't have otherwise. It's a genuine gift of an experience there, of being able to turn these things that were live in front of you onto to something that's on this film and, you know, is captured there.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
It's powerful. I missed photography. When I went down to Brighton and did my degree, and when I left college, I kind of... all my portfolio, pretty much, I had published just before I left college.
Yeah.
I had published in The Guardian and The Independent and that. So it was like, look at this guy. But I left college with, like, nothing.
Yeah.
In terms of, I'm like, I've sold all my work and now I've got to generate more. And
yeah.
I started to realise this is not going to be an easy experience to try and, you know, stay up and afloat in this game.
Yeah, of course.
But, sometimes I just think that there's a, you know, fate takes you where it's going to take you. And I always, throughout that time, still I still love cinema. I worked at cinemas, and at the time Pulp Fiction had come out, and so everybody wanted to be a writer, filmmaker. Yeah. Everyone was getting jobs in video shops because Tarantino worked in one and they have the same effect. But... You know, I definitely did. I brought those screenplays and I did aspire to write and make films. Not necessarily act. I wanted to make films.
Mm.
The acting thing, if I'm honest with you, around that time of leaving college, me and Shane were kind of hanging around again, and I was trying to make this little documentary on these ex-boxers, and he came down to the edit suite one day and he'd lent me cameras and stuff, and he was making a room for Romeo Brass. And he just said to me, I've got a part in this film and I can't cast it. And I was like, all right. You know, I didn't have any association with his films in that way. I wouldn't assume for 1 minute he was thinking of me. And he said, I want you to have a go at it.
Amazing.
And I was like, I don't think so. You know, that was my initial thing. Was like, I'm not sure. And he goes, listen, just have a go, and if it doesn't work, it don't matter. We're still mates.
Yeah.
He goes, but just give it a go, you know. And so I did. I remember I went to the Central Workshop, and I went in there not knowing what an audition was, not knowing how this thing was going to play out. The only experience I'd had of it was a few school plays and a youth theatre group. And I sat there in the room, and there was about 20 kids all auditioning for Romeo Brass, and I had to audition all 20 of them.
Wow.
And I had to improvise and come up with something for each kid. And I don't... And honestly, to this day, Pip, I have no idea what took over me.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened in that chair. I don't know how I managed to come up. I didn't know where the words were coming from. I didn't know... The things were just happening that were out of my
Amazing.
Control, so I just went with it. And afterwards, Shane was like, "Yeah, man, you've got the part." And I was like, "What? Just like that? Is that what
That's
you do?"
How simple sort of it is.
But
I mean,
and then the character became for that what it became later on. We kind of rehearsed that for like a couple of months we were always getting together, 3 months even. And then the actual character with the accent didn't click in until a couple of days before filming.
Oh,
it
wow.
Just, again, that just came out of nowhere.
To come in. 'Cause it's, I mean, it's one of my favourite characters. I think Morel, just the way that he's so bizarre, yet so relatable. You can instantly think, yeah, I know, I've known people along those lines. And just the switch from the comedy and lightness of him to the darkness was just, I remember watching it. I remember, I think I was at college at that point, and, I just left college, and a friend of mine, Dan Harris, had recommended it. And he wasn't like, he seemed to be into films. He wasn't someone I particularly thought of as a real film buff and nerd, so yeah. I was skeptical. And I put it on, and as I said, number one, I'm drawn straight in by all the performances in reality. I think everyone was great in it and so natural. And it's what I then came to learn of the way Shane directs in many ways, that it all just feels like there happens to be a camera there, if you know what I mean. So, and then, just the switching and the darkness and just all of it, the simplicity of the comeuppance at the end, obviously not trying to spoil anything for anyone who's not seen it, just all of that. I can't remember many characters I've felt so much that I wanted to get their comeuppance by the end of it. And again, it's not like he's Darth Vader or some supervillain, but I think it's because it was so real and relatable that you kind of do go, this guy needs, this isn't on.
He's definitely on dodgy ground.
Yeah.
I just think there's a kid like that on every estate, you know. And that was the thing that I got back, is like, I grew up with a kid like that. And
yeah, completely. I think everyone must have had that, despite how weird and ludicrous he is.
Yeah, he's extreme, but I remember driving across the Trent Bridge at home with my wife, and sometimes in summer you get like people jumping off the bridge into the water.
Yeah.
And we drove along and I looked and I went, there's Morel. And there was a guy, he was 6 foot tall, about, you know, wiry, not a bit of fat on him.
Yeah.
And had just this gang of kids around him. And he was leading the charge of jumping off the bridge, you know, getting them in line. Brilliant. Who was going to jump. And I thought, there he is, he's right there. Like, commanding these kids to jump, and he was jumping himself. And
amazing.
I thought, they're everywhere.
So how was that when that completed and became a thing? As you'd said previously, you'd started a lot of things and not finished them, and then obviously doing your university course was a change of that. But how was that in the completion of a film, of something like that, of getting to the end of it and going, wow, there's something here?
It was still a strange one. I mean, as far as completing stuff, that stuff got nailed straight away. I think during my second year of university was the year that everything seemed to click for me. It was like there was all this stuff going on and I couldn't get it to kind of, I couldn't work. I had all these ideas. I had all this energy building in me and I couldn't put it anywhere. And I got a warning letter off the college saying, if you don't book your ideas up by Easter, you're out.
Right.
And three of us got the letter. I won't name the other two, but they're very, very... It's ironic that three of the most kind of successful guys out there were all the ones that got the letter.
That's amazing.
But I saw it for what it was. I was like, that's not... Guys, there's people on this course worse than us.
Yeah.
This is just a kick up the arse.
Yeah.
Because they care about us, and it was.
Exactly.
It was.
Exactly.
In that instance, it was.
It's the ones it's worth pushing to back their ideas up rather than just go, forget it then.
Yeah, it's like, get your shit together because, you know, we're 1.5 years in and you ain't. And I did. I went home and I did this photographic project on my parents and it just changed everything for me.
Yeah.
I could kind of, whatever was going on in my heart, I realised that I could translate it into photographs. I could say something with photographs and before they were just photographs, you know?
Yeah.
And that personal connection was the thing that kind of pushed me on, really. It was a big discovery for me.
Yeah, that's great.
But after Romeo Brass, I mean, you know, there was nothing. I was just living at home. And me and Shane had just make short films and things and mess about. I had time on my hands, he did, and, you know. But it wasn't until Romeo Brass came out that I got an agent and the film got a good response and, you know, the reviews were good and I got a bit of a mention. And then. But the thing that really turned it was, because I never felt like an actor, and I still don't, Pip. And I think sometimes that's been a bit, you know, when I do press interviews, it's always seemed like a little bit derogatory, or I'm down on acting, or... but I'm not. I respect it as a craft. I just always had that, until recently, I had that feeling that, yeah, someone was going to tap me on the shoulder and go, hey, we found out.
Yeah.
That you're no good.
Yeah, you snuck in.
Yeah, you snuck in, mate, and there's the door. And, of course, it's ludicrous. It's open, the field's open to anybody to get in there and get involved. But I did have this thing in me. There was a compulsion with some of those characters. There was something, I don't want to call it an exorcism, it's too grand, but there was definitely something shifting with Romeo Brass. And even with, the one for me was, well, Romeo Brass, I still think, it was my favourite experience. But the thing that changed the acting, that people's impressions about my acting over, was when I did sort of Last Resort. I did Pavel Pavlikovsky's film.
Yeah,
and we were kind of working towards doing that, and Pavel was sending all these crazy ideas to me, and we'd go on road trips together, and he'd throw stuff about my characters and go, maybe your character is kind of crazy, or what if your character studies the clouds, what if you, you know, and all this stuff. And it got to the point where we were finding, or Pavel was kind of finding angles to make this guy crazy, because he loved the performance in Romeo Brass.
Right, right.
And he's going, how can we make this guy crazy? And it was all affectations.
So it's changed,
and I said, Pavel, you know, what if he's just a bloke?
Yeah.
You know, why does he have to have all this shit over him?
Yeah.
And that's what I did with Last Resort. It's just like, if I'm going to do anything, I've got to show the flip side to morale.
Yeah,
I can't,
completely.
I don't want to bring out this. So that was a conscious thing for me of like, I thought, if I'm going to do this and have a career, I've got to show people the kind of flip side. I can't just keep turning that out.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it's noticeable in Last Resort and in, was it in America?
Yeah.
Was after that. Again, it's the playing, the getting a lot of attention for playing such a weird and diverse and out there character, and then playing really kind of human, really regular, really, you know, this could be... Or the everyman type thing, I guess, in a way. So how was that to go from... And did you feel nerves? I know you said you kind of feel you're always about to be exposed, but nerves from going from working with your friend Shane, who you'd known for years, to Pavel and to, you know, all different places.
Well, from Shane, I was in great company, and I jumped from Shane to Pavel Pavlikovsky, and again, I was in great company.
Yeah.
So I was like, I was blessed with that.
Yeah.
It was like just...
this is great.
Pavel's is a kind of different sort of madness to step into.
Yeah.
But it was... But I was very lucky with that. So, I mean, the only time I felt utter fear was... I'd got an agent at the time, and it was like... Oh, here, jobs come up, and you know, they'd like you for it. And I was like, okay, well, you know, and I looked at it, and it was a film called Born Romantic, and it was just a little part for me in it. That was my first experience of acting,
right?
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I was doing it at the same time as Last Resort, and it paid me five times more than Last Resort. It wasn't a fortune, but it was five times more,
yeah.
And that was a really weird thing to get my head around and go. Well, but I'm doing this really great kind of piece here.
Just got to do a gig now, essentially, yeah.
Shit, and it was my first gig, and I met some beautiful people on it. I met Dave Morrissey on it, and he was the first. I remember coming out of my trailer, your three-way thing, and I'm looking over, and there was John Thompson, who I was a big fan of John Thompson's, you know, for all the Coogan stuff and that.
Yeah.
There's Ian Hart,
yeah,
you know, and Jane Horrocks, and I'm going, shit. And I'm standing there, like, kind of slightly trembling, and then this dude walks up to me, all right, mate, puts his hand out, you know, Dave. And it's Dave Morrissey, and he was the guy that came over to me. And
that's awesome.
And it always stayed with me, you know, and he's always stayed a friend, you know.
Even though I
don't see him as much, but he was the one that put me at ease. But I never felt comfortable in that film.
Yeah.
And then a pattern emerged in some of the jobs that I did that I never, whenever I felt like I was doing a job, it never felt comfortable to me.
Yeah. That's interesting that there is a clear difference in that, in the ones that you're I don't know, you're passionate about or that just feel right, I guess. Because not to say that any that you're doing a job on or whatever that you're not putting 100% into. Obviously, you're going to be doing what you have to do. But it's odd to think of, because you generally think of film and acting and all that, as we said, as kind of being up there on the screens. It's odd to think that there's certain roles that's just your living.
Yeah.
You know, that's not, it's not, wow, this character, I need to, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, because you want to commit to everything, but at times in my life, I remember after In America, I think it was, I was at home and I said, you know what, I'm not going to work, you know, I'm just going to wait for the really great stuff to come through the door.
Yeah.
I'm not committing to any old thing just to pay the bills. I'm going to tough this out and the great roles will come. And I didn't work for a year.
Yeah.
You know, nothing happened. And I thought, wow. I'm sitting at home and while I'm sitting at home, nobody's banging my door down. And also, I'm not getting any experience doing this job. Yeah.
Again, it's all hours on the job, like regardless of what the job is. And the whole thing, in music, they always say you have to, in most things, I say you have to put in 100 hours of whether it be gig time, you know, gym time or whatever else, and then you know if you're good or not at it. And so it's kind of, it's getting them hours in, I guess, putting in those.
It is. I suppose.
Refining the art form.
As a photographer, I'd kind of had an apprenticeship. I went to work with a photographer called Steve Pike.
Right.
And I went down to Hastings and worked for him. I basically printed for him.
Yeah.
And I was doing like 20 or 30 prints a day. And over that summer, I became a shit hot printer.
Yeah.
You know, and I went back to my third year and everyone was, a lot of people, you know, that third year panic in your degree and everyone's flapping around. I was in the zone. I was like, this is a walk.
Because you'd put the hours in.
I'd done it, you know, and I'd learnt my apprenticeship and I felt ready. With acting, I never had it.
Yeah.
I never had it. Yeah, I never, right. I was still kind of going, I don't really know how to do this.
Yeah.
Instinct's one thing, you know.
That feeling of those moments happened.
Yeah.
But that might never happen again. You know, I didn't plan for that. That just happened.
And what am I doing? It's like you can be that actor who turns up and goes, yeah, I don't need to know what I'm doing. I just turn up and let it take over.
Yeah.
But at some point, you've got to acknowledge that this is a craft. Yeah. I always use the analogy of Manny Pacquiao, great fighter, you know, great two-handed fighter, brilliant, you know, but raw. Goes to Freddie Roach, refines his technique and becomes a multi-weight world champion.
Yeah.
You know, and I just felt that I was lacking that. I had the rawness, but I felt that I was lacking
that
some
structure
kind of technique.
And guide.
Even with regard, and that's never left me really with acting, even though I've had years of experience of it now, that's never seemed to leave me. It's kind of weird because the other week, my band supported the Charlatans.
Wow, yeah.
In Leicester. And we walked out onto the stage, you know, and there's probably about 1,000 people there. It wasn't quite to capacity by that point. It filled.
Yeah.
When we finished, you know, and the Charlatans come out, it was like they were hanging off the ceiling. But, you know, there's a good 1,000 people in that place. And we walked on and we did our support set and it was just perfect.
Mm.
It felt perfect.
Yeah.
It felt like, if it had happened 2 years earlier or something wouldn't have felt quite right. We wouldn't have been quite ready at something. But we just walked on there and we're like, we've done enough gigs. We've been together 10 years nearly. We've done enough shows, played in pubs, played to three people.
So you've done all the tough gigs.
And it's like, we did all that.
Yeah.
And there's going to be more tough gigs to come. But in that moment, to stand on that stage and to do what we did with Half Hour, we were ready.
Well, again, you'd know. Yeah, that's it. You'd earned it. You'd,
yeah.
You'd done that. You'd paid the dues, as it were. And it's like now it's yeah.
Yeah. And with acting, I've never felt that at all.
So how was it to then come back with Shane for Dead Man's Shoes? Which, when that, you know, that was the one that really seemed to propel you and Shay and everyone kind of, there was so much excitement and respect around that. I always remember it became my go-to film to recommend to people because it was the same year that Layer Cake had come out and Layer Cake was the big British gangster movie and it was always, this is the British gangster movie that you need to see because it's that more real, it was the real drug dealers in your town rather than you know, the cinematic, explosive versions of them, the real ones and the real...
Real drug dealers do nip to the co-op.
Yeah, yeah.
To get a litre of Diet Coke.
Exactly, exactly. So how was that experience of the filming, and did you know when you were filming it that, wow, this feels like something?
No, I didn't. It was a weird one. But by that time I'd gone off and done in America, and Shane did Once Upon a Time in the Midlands.
Yep.
And Shane had me down for a role in Once Upon a Time in the Midlands, and I didn't do it. I did in America. And I think I made the right choice just for myself, because it wasn't the role that I wanted in Midlands. I didn't want to play the Dell. I think his name was Dell. Right. Reese Fans played him eventually. Yeah. And I just thought, well, I don't want to play that part. You know, we'd done a short film together that was... You know, that, and I'd improvised it, and that's what that I think that character that Robert Carlyle came to play, that's kind of where it was based, sort of.
Right.
It's
right,
years
yeah.
ago, but it was sort of around that sort of thing.
Sure, I see.
And I.
So it would have felt odd playing someone else in a thing that you feel.
Yeah, and I just thought, well, I don't really want to play that part, you know. So I went and did in America, and I wanted to do in America.
Yeah.
I wanted to work with Jim Sheridan.
Yeah.
There was a lot of things attached to that film at the time. You know, my dad was Irish. He was dying of cancer. He died a couple of weeks before we started filming it. And I was like, you know, kind of, Jim's the man in Ireland. I want to work with the guy. Yeah. I sat and watched My Left Foot and The Boxer with my dad. I'm like, I'm watching this. But even when my dad was dying, he was going, you don't let Shane down, you know. And I'm like, oh, fucking hell, Dad. Give me a break.
On your
but
case.
But it was right, because these things happen and they're right to happen too. And I made the right decision. And then when we came back together again, it was to make Dead Man's Shoes. And Shane had made a film that he wasn't satisfied within America.
Right.
With the Midlands.
Yeah.
I know he wouldn't mind me saying that he wasn't satisfied with it, but I think it was one of the best things that happened to him. Like a lot of these things, you know, they seem like a bad experience, but actually it was probably the catalyst for everything that came after.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dead Man's Shoes and Summer's Town, This Is England, all of it,
completely.
I think.
That realisation that hopefully what you're working on now, obviously you have to put everything in to make that amazing, but hopefully that's just the start of the years and years and years of a career to come. And that's often hard to see at the time, particularly I'd imagine in film, when that such an takes over your whole life. But that realization, that if that has or hasn't worked, it's all a step on the path that hopefully is going upwards.
And I think it was a tough time in a lot of respects, but I don't want to speak for Shane, but I think it was tough, you know. I think he learned a lot about how he wanted to make film, by making Midlands, and I think it turned it around for him.
Definitely.
But we came to make Dead Man's Shoes, and Shane seemed to be in that place. I'd done in America then. I'd done Cinderella. I had a little part in Cinderella Man, but I had a wonderful time doing that. It was amazing. But we came together for Dead Man's Shoes, and it was kind of weird. We met up that morning. We went out to have some dinner. Shane was following us in his car, me and my wife, who was a couple of months pregnant, in our car. And we get rammed off the road, and our car flips and overturns, you know. And
oh, wow.
So we're in a car. We had a most bizarre day. We're in a car accident with my pregnant wife. We climb out of it, and the car gets picked up. We go and have dinner. And then we go back to my gaff and we sit there and start talking, and the beginnings of Dead Man's Shoes start to
happen.
And then Mark Herbert was the real catalyst, because I'd worked with him on Chris Morris's short film, and I kind of put him and Shane together, and they're still working together today.
Yeah.
But you know, Mark was kind of full of enthusiasm to get this film off the ground. And we pitched it as a comedy. Oh, we're going to make a comedy about this guy who thinks he's a superhero before all this superhero business.
Yeah.
And but it just was not working at all.
Right.
It was not happening. Something was stopping us from doing it. And then we sat there one day and said, we're not making this. Let's make let's make the film that we want to make. We'd just been, at the time, I was down at the boxing club training, and Shane was coming down with me at the time. And I remember we stood outside for about an hour after, and we just talked about bullies. And we just talked about people that, you know, in that moment where you'd back down or been afraid, where you think you should have absolutely smashed them in the teeth, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we were getting all this kind of juice going about those guys, and we're going, these people, Shane had grown up with them. I'd grown up around similar stories of, like, these kind of these people with no morals who do these kind of awful things to other people, and there's no consequence.
Yeah.
And they're done in the name of recreation. And then somehow we started writing it. We did have a script for Dead Man's, and I'd go to Shane's, he'd come to mine, and we'd write it, and we'd reenact scenes.
Mm.
You know, I'd go outside and knock on the door, and he'd come and answer it, and all climb out. You know, and the neighbours, if they saw anything, must have thought, what are that pair up to? But it worked. It became the story, you know, that idea of the kind of vigilante became very... apparent that was going to be the thread through the film.
Yeah.
And so it was one of those projects that we got the money, but I can't remember what the budget was, but it wasn't a lot. And we just went off and made it with the very bare basics. And we were still worrying. Well, I was worrying more than Shane about the idea of the brother and thinking, you know, should he be in it? I don't want to ruin the film for anyone who hasn't seen it.
Yeah.
I'm going, should he be present with me in these scenes or not? And I was the one going, it might be a bit kind of naff. It might be rubbish. And, of course, if he wasn't there with me, there wouldn't have been a film.
Yeah.
There wouldn't have been a twist in the story.
Again, I can understand how there would have been that doubt and fear on paper, but in what you guys actually made and came up with, it's essential. And it works so well.
And it works as well because... by the time we got to make it, I mean, I stayed away from all that. I had nothing to do with casting of that film. I think very early on, Shane asked me casting somebody, and I was like a bit negative about it. I was like, oh, I'm not sure about him, you know. And then I just kind of realised, and I called him back. I was like, listen, man, you cast who you want. This isn't our conversation.
Yeah.
And I realised then, I was like, this isn't where I want to be.
Yeah.
We've written this thing together, but the thing that works about us is when we go on set, you're director, I'm actor.
Yeah.
And anything that kind of gets in the way of that dynamic is just noise.
That's great. That's great to realise that and be able to let go of the reins in that way and know that... work to both of your strengths, essentially, and go, here's how it is.
Yeah, this is how it works. I've always been like that with directors. I've always, and sometimes to my detriment, you know. But, like, I've always been, you're the boss. This is your craft, you know. Yeah. You tell me, or I'll present something and we can turn it, we can change it. But I'm not going to... I don't want to come and impose my will on this thing, you know. Yeah. On this project, and I find that works when you're with it. But it depends on the director. If you're with a good director, it does work. If I look down my CV and I go, good film, good, yeah, and I go across, and there's always a good director at the other end of the line, and going, yeah, because it had a good director.
So do you feel you took a lot from all the people you worked with when you were then directing on Tyrannosaur?
Yeah.
Obviously, that was a difference to go from writing... I'm not sure if you wrote it completely on your own, or was there...
Tyrannosaur?
Yeah,
I wrote it on my own,
How was that as... obviously, we're jumping over a lot of stuff, which we might rewind back to at some point, but how was that to go from that experience of writing with Shane and then being able to go, right, it's over to you now, I'm now the actor, to writing on your own and then not being the actor... Or was it tempting at all to put yourself
in
the film? No,
it was easy with Shane, because I understood our dynamic, and it's all about dynamics. Yeah. It's all it's about, you know. And so I had to respect that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
But I'd written... I mean, the real catalyst, it's funny because I remember the press for Tyrannosaur coming out and people going, oh, and he's acknowledged his mentor, Shane Meadows, and he's obviously learnt a lot from the master of shame. And Shane was embarrassed by that.
Right.
Shane came round my house and went, why do they keep writing that kind of shit? Like, you're on... The truth is, I never had any communication with Shane through the whole year process of making Tyrannosaur.
You see, I remember when I saw it, and a thing that struck me, it didn't even cross my mind any Shane Meadows angle, but I felt the thing that struck me and excited me was you seem to get the kind of performance that you put in Dead Man's Shoes. You seem to get that out of Olivia and Peter and all these amazing, and Eddie, who were just all amazing in it. And it was like, that's weird, because it felt like a Paddy Considine film, but you weren't on screen. Do you know what I mean? It somehow you seem to get your own acting style and intensity, I guess, at points through, but, you know, obviously other people doing it, essentially.
Yeah. I suppose what I'd done is, because in the past I'd, you know, improvise, like, you know, Romeo Brass was improvised.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we wrote a script for Dead Man's Shoes, but it was kind of improvised. It's probably I can pick about three or four lines out of that thing where I go, oh, I wrote that.
Yeah, yeah,
That's it. And I remember them being in there, it's but
crazy,
that's
it. Isn't it.
But that's how Shane works. Yeah. It's not how I work as a writer and director. I didn't write Tyrannosaur and go, right, now I want everybody, you know, to improvise. That's not how I work.
Yeah.
I wrote a script. And the fact that people were, like, asking me at Q&As, well, you know, how much was improvised? It's like, none of it was improvised.
Yeah, wow.
Of course we navigate, you know, scenes. Of course Peter can drop a word and put it, you know, it doesn't matter, but the film is not improvised.
Yeah.
It's not me going, here's a scenario, off you go.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I've got a vague idea, but let's bash it out and see if you could. Never. Those words were written on that page. And I wrote them for those actors.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I met...
It's fascinating to have that discipline when you've worked previously in scenarios where so much is improvised. I'd imagine, because again, it is discipline, I think, on writing in that manner, and not to say that in any way that Shane is lazy, but I'd imagine it's an easier approach at points to go, right, let's just get on with it and see, rather than sit on your own in a room and get from beginning to end, you know.
Yeah, well, I kind of... Tyrannosaur was written very quickly, too.
Yeah.
And it was one of those real bursts of energy that just came out. And that thing was in my head marinating for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But you know, Shane works very differently to me. And his technique is totally different. But Shane will create a big world and then he'll carve it down.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And so it becomes very concentrated, and then the threads of the plot come through.
Yeah.
And it's like a sculptor. You know, we just do it differently.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's great though.
And so Shane will let it run and build this big thing, and then he'll just bring it right down. And that's how he creates his drama.
Yeah.
But I didn't do that. I can't think like that. If I had too much, it would drive me mad.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
the fact that, you know, the script of Tyrannosaur was 81 pages, and when I went into meetings with people and they were like, oh, the average script is 100 pages or 120, and I said, this is a movie. I know it because I've walked it.
Yeah.
I've seen it already.
Yeah.
And that's a hard one for people to get their heads around, because that suggests that you're kind of very stuck in how you're making your film.
Yeah.
It's not true. But I knew how it was going to... I knew it. I knew the way I wanted to shoot it. I knew how the camera was going to move.
Yeah.
And so did Eric Wilson, who's the unsung absolute hero of Tyrannosaurus, the DOP Eric Wilson.
Yeah.
As talk about telepathy between actors, I mean, that guy was on it.
Yeah.
He was all over that film. I mean, he'd show me an opening frame. There was probably two or three times during the whole shoot where I went, maybe we just move it around here a bit. It's a bit flat on. Should
That's
we start it there?
You know, to have that connection and have that that shorthand, so it's not... It, in a way, it doesn't have to all be... I don't know... spoon-fed in such a manner. If you've got someone that's just like, you're on the same... way, you've both got the same vision, literally the same vision with the film, then... that's an amazing find, surely, in such a project.
Very lucky. And that's the guy that shot Submarine. You know, I saw him on Submarine and was like, what's this guy doing? You know, he's pulling a lamp, desk lamp over to light something while he's holding the camera. And I'm going, oh, he's my dude. He was like Richard Lenchevsky, who did Last Resort and Summer of Love and Ida. Yeah, you know, yeah. He's like that. That was that guy.
Yeah, and Submarine was another one that just it looked beautiful. Yeah. I mean, your look was wonderful in
oh,
that.
My there look was amazing. A hell of a look.
But yeah, that's great to find someone in that kind of scenario. Then I guess and just go.
Yeah,
he just make note of that.
He knew. I think guy. Eric. I don't know. Well, Eric has worked with Richard Iwadi a couple of times, and I don't know. I imagine Richard. I imagine because I haven't had the conversation, but that he's pretty extensive about his stuff. He knows his film onions.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he knows his stuff. Whereas I'm not like that. I don't really know. I just know what I feel.
Yeah,
and I know. I know what I want, and that's just how I work. But the idea of the script and all that stuff, I wasn't dogged about my script, but I was definitely, if I've written a scene that works perfectly well, then there's nothing to figure out.
Yeah,
it doesn't make me a genius. I there's a story about Tyrannosaur. That's I've always tell it to people, and I tell it because it's a massive credit to Olivia Colman, and also it says a lot about the nature of creativity and about how things aren't set in concrete and about how you're not always right and you've got to be aware enough to know that, you know, that sometimes what you've got isn't working.
Yeah.
And I'd written this scene and we shot it in the first week, and Peter Mullen had gone round to see her in the shop again. And the whole scene was about him, you know, I want to kill somebody. And she goes, like, who? It's not me. And he goes, no, not you. There's a bloke. Oh, right. You know, and he's basically the Paul Popplewell's character.
Right.
And he goes into one about love and life and all this shit, you know. And on page, I thought it was amazing. I thought I'd written a great scene.
Yeah.
Olivia, I shoot Olivia on it. She is not there. This is in the first week. She's not there.
Yeah.
And I'm like going... And in the first week, we'd shot most of the stuff that we did in the short film, Dog All Together. We kind of reshot it.
Right, yeah.
And I'm going, she's not there, man. There's something, I'm not buying this.
Mm.
And I spoke to her and I said, look, this isn't you. These aren't your words. They're hers. You know, you've got to own this character. Yeah, we'd spoke a lot about owning her. And on the first day, Olivia had gone to the door to turn a door sign and looked at me during the take as if she goes, is this okay? And I'm like, do what you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to put the closed sign on the door while you pray for this guy? Do it. This is your space.
Yeah.
You know, and establishing that kind of playground where you can do that. And this scene was abysmal. She wasn't getting it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know if I've made a massive mistake casting her.
Yeah.
Seriously, I'm like,
wow.
I don't know if I don't know. We had some places to go after that.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, I don't know if I've done the right thing here. And by the end of the week, I reshot her close-up. I said, I'm doing that scene again. I'm going to shoot your close-up because I didn't believe you. You weren't there. And she shot it. We shot it again. And she was better. She was definitely better.
Yeah.
But there was something not there. I didn't know this until a couple of years ago. But she went home that weekend and cried. And said to her husband, "I'm just not doing it for Paddy. I can't do it." Whatever conversation they had and what doubts I had over the weekend of like, have I done the right thing here? She's never proved herself. You know, she hasn't done this kind of thing. Whatever conversation her and Ed had, her husband, she came back on the Monday like a kind of, she was like possessed or something. She just came back. Like, it was quite breathtaking. And, you know, when people talk, Olivia's great and everything, Olivians are great. Listen, man, listen. She's in Tyrannosaur, she transcends in Tyrannosaur.
Yeah, completely.
This isn't just turning up and turning on the fucking tears and all the rest of it. She transcended in that film. And I saw it, I witnessed it, and it was powerful.
Yeah.
Powerful.
Completely, because, I mean, as much of a fan of her work as I've always been, as soon as you were saying there that you had uncertainty, I completely understood that, because until Tyrannosaur, I hadn't seen that from her. Obviously, it's no denying that she was great in a lot of things, but you hadn't seen that, so it's a jump and an assumption to go, right, she's good in that kind of role, in that she can therefore...
Yeah.
switch it to this, which obviously you got in the end, and she very much delivered in the end.
And we worked on it because we became, all the actors, all of us, became almost like telepathy.
Yeah.
It's so hard to explain. And my biggest fear is that I'll never experience that ever again.
Yeah.
I'll never experience that level of kind of creation, really.
Yeah.
Of kind of love, if I'm honest. It was just powerful. And I, to kind of get to the end of the story, you know, Olivia comes and she's smashing it. And we're like trainer and fighter. You know, I always use those analogies because it's where I'm comfortable.
Yeah.
I'll be Freddie Roach. I'll train you. I'll be in the corner. You come back to me at the end of the round while I whisper in your ear and let's go out for one more round. And I love all that. And I felt like if I'd have said bite, she'd have bitten, you know. It was powerful.
Yeah.
She was just in some creative place. Peter was too. They were all just amazing.
Yeah.
But it was a transformation for Olivia.
Yeah.
And to cut it short, this very long story, I looked back at the scene in the edit and I'm watching the scene. And this is the scene that I'd reshot on her.
Yeah.
The best scene I'd ever written. And I looked at it and I looked at her and I went, yeah, she's not quite there still, is she? She's not, but, you know, I can use take three because I think that was all right. And then I look at Peter in it and I go, Peter's not that good in it either. And I watch this thing and I go, if Peter isn't feeling it, there's something wrong.
Yeah.
And then I realised, I went, the scene's shit.
Wow.
It's just shit, you know. It's not, the film didn't need it.
Yeah.
It's not a great scene. He's uncomfortable in it, and he hasn't been uncomfortable in the whole thing.
Yeah.
She's dying in it, and she's, you know, so what's the problem? And I went, the scene's crap.
Wow.
But the fact that I shot it, and that process, and that emphasis on Olivia, that became the catalyst
for everything.
For everything.
And it's amazing.
That to me is creativity. That's just brilliant.
The fact that possibly the most important scene never made it into the film.
Yeah.
Because it ignited everything. That's crazy.
Yeah. And it was just weakly written.
Yeah.
and they were feeling it.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing, filmmaking, Pip, because you have some things that are two lines and they're amazing, and then you have other things where you go, and this is a bit, this isn't very good. And then you give it to actors and they make it into gold.
Yeah.
And then vice versa, you know, it's just a give and take process all the way through.
It's amazing. So to go on a completely different feel and type of film, how was it working on Hot Fuzz and The World's End with Simon? I've had Simon and Nick on here separately.
Have you now?
Over the months. So how was that experience? And how was it to get your... I don't know. Obviously, there was some comedy in the Room for Romeo Brass vibe, but it was very much that was drained out of it as soon as the film went on. If you know what I mean,
you
felt bad for finding it amusing because you saw how dark a character it was. How was that to get to? It's still my favourite line in Hot Fuzz when you've got a moustache and it's just, I know. Well, when it's with the beard, just golden. But how was that to work with those guys?
You know, people watch Romeo Brass or Dead Man's Shoes in particular, and they think I'm a really angry, you know, aggressive guy. Yeah. And it's like, I'm an absolute tool. You know, and I don't know what they probably... Well, what happened was Sean had come out and Dead Man's Shoes was out. So we were doing the circuit together a bit, you know, with Edgar and Nick and Simon. And so we got to know each other a little bit, and it was brilliant. You know, I'd really, really like those guys. And then it came about, they sent me Sean. I can't remember which part it was now, but and I didn't do it, obviously, for whatever reason. But The World's End, Hot Fuzz came around. I'll tell you a story about Hot Fuzz. And it just seemed very natural to do it. I mean, I really liked them.
Yeah.
And I loved Shaun of the Dead. I actually loved that movie.
Yeah. Fantastic.
I didn't see it for a long time, and then I watched it, and I was just like, "This is an amazing film. This is what it's all about."
Yeah.
If you're gonna do this kind of thing, then you do it like Edgar Wright does it. Yeah, I thought 100%. It was original. I think it's my favourite zombie film.
Yeah.
There's too many zombie shit, too much dark zombie shit out there these days for me, Pip. But that it's was something else.
Yeah.
I remember they approached me for Hot Fuzz, and I was like, I'd love to work with you, you know? And I meet with Edgar and we do a bit of a workshop or whatever it is. And it goes, or I don't know how it's gone. I don't know if it's gone well or not, you know, but I go home and then I went out to Los Angeles, and it was the first trip out there to just go, you know, do the agent thing, you know, do the general meet stuff. Yeah. I went out there and I got offered about 3 jobs.
Yeah.
Like that. And my agent was going, what are you doing when you go in the room? I said, I don't know. I'm just talking to him about that. Because you've been offered all these films. And out of them, the possibility came about that there was 2 of them that I could do.
Yeah.
And I looked at this thing in Hot Fuzz and I went, you know, we haven't done a contract or a deal. And I look and go, oh, it's only a little part. Anyone can do that. You know, like it's kind of a, not a cameo, but I'm going, nah, it's just a little part. So I kind of go, well, listen, I can do 2 films here. And, you know, instead of that one where I'm just in it every now and again, I've got 2 good films. So, you know, I'll do them. And the word got out, oh, Paddy's been offered these things and he's going to do them. And, you know, so he can't do Hot Fuzz now. Edgar Wright, who's the toughest son of a bitch you could ever meet, dug his heels in and was like, there's no way that he's not doing my film.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I mean, I don't mind talking about it. I think it's funny because I love him so much and they're my friends. But I was going to be sued by, you know, I had Simon ringing me up going, listen, what's happening? Because they're talking about suing you.
Oh, wow.
For walking off it. It's amazing we're still friends.
Yeah.
But it made me laugh. But I was like going, sue me? What for? I said, it's just a fucking little part, mate. I said, you can get, relax. Of all the people they knew in comedies and things, sure. I said, you can get someone to play that fucker. You know, like, it's not the main role, man. I haven't left you, like, hanging. No. Edgar's like, no. You said you'd do it, and you're doing it, or we're going to sue you. Those weren't his words, but that was what was coming back to me, was like, and Simon was on the phone to me, and I was like, look, and I got off the phone, and I actually was smiling. I was like, wow, this fucking guy really, like, really wants me in his film.
Yeah.
He I kind of admired him for it.
Yes.
So when we went into rehearsals, it was just never, it was never an issue. There was never that thing in the back of my mind, all theirs, that, oh, you were going to leave our film and we were going to sue you.
That's amazing.
It was just like,
to all have been able to move on from that so seamlessly, man, you know.
But it was funny. And I love them. And do you know what? I walk into the first rehearsal of Hot Fuzz, and who's the first person I meet? I go to walk through the door. She goes through and I go, after you. And she goes, no, after you. And there's Olivia Colman. And I look and I go, oh, God, there's the girl from my film.
Wow.
And I ring my wife. I say, I've just found her. I found her, the girl. Her name's Olivia Colman. I've just this minute. She's the one.
Amazing.
That was it. It's amazing how it guides you, in it, Pip? This old force, they call it.
It really is.
And it's amazing. But yeah, and then we did Hot Fuzz. And, man, it was one of the best experiences ever.
Yeah.
And I met Rafe Spall.
Yeah.
We met at Bristol, I think, train station or whatever, a little hotel opposite.
Yeah.
And the first time I met Rafe, and we went to meet some police, some detectives, West Country detectives, you know, a bit of research and all that.
Yeah.
And these guys had us in their offices telling us all their horror stories. And they were just like the Andes. They were offering us cake.
Really?
And, brilliant. Would you like a bit of flapjack? You know, and we're looking at each other going, Jesus Christ, I'm thinking, has Edgar tipped him off or something? Because that's the joke in the film, they're always eating cake and ice cream. I'm going up the shop, mate, you want a flapjack? Do you?
It's amazing.
So that, and then they were kind of showing us all these grotesque pictures of death.
Yeah.
They couldn't wait to get them out at the end. They're going, oh, do you want to see some photographs now? You know, and I was like, I'm kind of all right, you know. But
kind of good, I can imagine.
And these photographs were kind of horrific. But I just said to them, listen, man, no kids.
Yeah.
And shit like that. I don't want to see it, you know. And
yeah.
But they were kind of gruesome. But they loved showing us these gruesome photographs. They thought it was a lot of fun. But me and Rafe became quite inseparable on it. You know, we became the Andes.
Brilliant.
There wasn't no method acting. We just enjoyed. Luckily, we met and we became mates.
Yeah.
And we were like the kind of school, not bullies, but we were the annoying, you know, schoolboys.
Yeah.
And it worked out fantastic. What a cast. And then the experience came around again. You know, I got a call from Edgar and, do you want to do The World's End? And it was like a no-brainer to me. I actually did look at the character in that and go, oh, man, you know, these guys get to do all the good shit. And
yeah.
There was a bit of that ego play, but you know, I love them so much. And I'm like, if I can be around them and spend time with them, I always know that it's going to be...
Yeah.
We're going to have fun.
It's got to be an enjoyable way to work. If you have one like that, or as you said, you were just... getting on, you just became mates, and it's just kind of, it feels like that's just the ultimate,
yeah,
you know, way to work in that type of film, in that type of area. It's like, that's, yeah.
And The World's End was a tough film to make.
Yeah.
Very tough. It was hard. It really was. Simon worked his arse off. I think he was in every day, but yeah. it was tough. But, and Edgar's, I have so much admiration for him as a filmmaker. He just, he doesn't let anything slide. He whatever, what he wants to do, he achieves it.
Yeah.
And I've got, you know, you meet Edgar and you could mistake him for being a bit of a pushover or something like that, but he's not.
But not at
he's,
all.
He's ragged and he's passionate about cinema.
Yeah.
And he's one of those guys, I always love being around him. Well, all of them are like it, really. They're so passionate about films. I never hear them say anything negative about other people's movies.
That's
great. I can be with Edgar and something can come up, and even if he didn't feel the overall film work, there's always something he'll pull out of a film to say, well, that was great.
Yeah.
I really... And I'm like, I like that. I love that about him.
Finding the good in everything. And realising that there's something to learn from all.
Yeah. And he's a man of integrity. There's a lot of filmmakers, they're walking into these big pictures, they're doing these superhero things, and they're kind of being pussy-whipped, if you want to call it that, by studios.
Yeah.
They're being taken and because they can be manipulated, and Edgar's a strong dude. And, you know, when he kind of walked off his production, there was, you know, I thought it was a really strong stance by him, because Edgar's an auteur. There's such thing as an Edgar Wright film. You know what you're watching. You could put 10 minutes of one on and go, this is Edgar Wright.
Yeah. It's true.
If you don't want that, don't hire him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, completely.
You let that man do his thing. He's an artist.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. We're nicely over the hour mark, but that's not important. There's loads more I want to talk to you about. I want to get on to Pride, because Pride was kind of an odd one for me, because I heard about it, and for some reason the posters and advertising, I think, I didn't feel like it was a film for me. I was like, I'll watch it at some point, but I didn't feel like I rushed out. And my girlfriend went to see it. In fact, before you and I did the Gittins
show,
so in that day she'd gone to see it, and she was like, it was fucking amazing. It was just, and I was like, that's interesting. Because I thought, I'm sure it'll be good, but I wasn't, you know, rushing into the cinema. And then I ended up going to see it at the cinema and was just blown away. I just thought, just everything about it was just so, for some reason, the posters and marketing, it felt like it would be kind of a bit of a Full Monty type feel and things like that, which it really isn't. I just thought the story told, that again, the performances from everyone across the board, and particularly when your character first comes out and gives his speech in the gay club, was just, you know, heart in my mouth kind of moment. So how was that, and how's the reception been? Because obviously that one is one where you were telling a hugely important story as well from history, a true story from history that was, again, I didn't particularly know that much about.
I didn't.
Hugely important and amazing. So, yeah, how was that?
It was amazing. I mean, thank God for the sort of, you know, I'm not a genius. And thank God that there's people out there like, you know, Stephen Beresford and Matthew Warchus, and somewhere in their brains went, oh, we need someone to play a kind of socialist, you know, striking miner.
Yeah.
Just an everyday kind of guy. Look, let's get the guy from Dead Man's Shoes to do that, you know.
Yeah.
It took amazing... I think things like that take amazing... They're amazing leaps of faith, you know.
Yeah.
I first got it and I was like... My first reaction to the script was, why have I never heard about this story? I've never heard about it. My father-in-law was a miner. He's never heard of it.
Yeah.
How was it become so buried? Thematically, I knew what the film wanted to be, and I think when I was filming Pride, it was beautiful to be in a situation where you were making the film that you thought you were making. That might sound weird, this film knows what it wants to be. It's not making any apologies. I can remember Matthew Walsh is a pretty quiet guy. First kind of week in rehearsal, I'm a bit like, this guy doesn't hardly speak, you know. What's his story, you know?
Yeah.
And he came up to me on set in the first couple of days and gave me a note. I don't think it was around the pub scene, but he gave me a note. And the first note he gave me just took me sideways. And I went, this guy is just a director, you know, I hadn't worked with him before. You know, I know he'd done Matilda and things with massive success. I'm like, this guy knows what he's doing. You know, he's not one of those guys that talks a load of shit.
Yeah,
he's on it. He'll just come and give you a little whisper, and it's job done.
Yeah, that's great. But quietly observing, and then just speaking on when it's needed.
Yeah, on it. And first, I was grateful for the gig. The story was amazing.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that it actually happened. And then the cast was something else. And not just, you know, Bill, Imelda, the people we were...
I was going to say, huge cast as well. Just so many... Because of how the story is so expansive, it's just,
so many cast. And I actually was looking at Matthew at one point. I think I told him afterwards. I was like, I don't know how you did that. If somebody had came to me with that script and gone, we want you to direct this, Paddy... I'd have gone, no, I'd have run a mile.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going, there's too many people in it.
Yeah.
You know, my films don't have that many
characters.
Even the one they've written to do next, I'm going, it's not that many characters in it, man.
Yeah.
And it was another, like Hot Fuzz, it was the last time I'd had a similar experience was Hot Fuzz. It was just a joy.
Yeah.
Everybody was there for the project, they were there for the story. They were there to serve it.
Yeah.
And it was...
And that's what comes across, I think, is the dedication to getting that story across.
Yeah.
I had Billy Bragg on the podcast a few weeks back and was just saying that when his song comes on at the end, and it was just all like,
it's great.
It was all just too much at a point, but it was just, so overwhelmingly.
Yeah.
As you said, I think that's exactly it. I think you've nailed it there, where it knows exactly what it wants to be and it's unapologetic about it.
Yeah.
It's not trying to pander in this direction or that direction. It's going, here's the story that we need to tell.
Yeah.
You know, and how we need to tell it. And I don't know, somehow that just worked so perfectly, despite the vastness of the cast and the characters and everything that's being told.
I had a day on it. It was my last day on it. And it was when I first met the LGSM in the cafe. And these... I want to call them kids, but they're not, you know.
Yeah.
I think who was there that day? Faye and George, Ben, I think, was there. Freddie. They were all, pretty much all the LGSM were there.
Yeah.
And I'm doing this scene. And it was, I just was not there. I just couldn't. Something was not happening on me.
Right.
And they shot my stuff first, and it just... I just felt terrible because there was obviously something that wasn't coming from me, that I wasn't in it. I was distracted, and I went over to Matthew and I said, Matthew, do you mind? And this is a big setup, man. They've got to change light. And I said, Matthew, do you mind if I just do mine again? I said, I'm so sorry. I said, I don't feel it. And he went, we'll do it again. And I went to the... I think sometimes when you come in as an actor with more experience than them, sometimes I suppose you feel a bit of pressure to perform. I was putting pressure on myself to get it right or perform it right.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to let yourself down in front of these young actors, you know?
Yeah, sure, of course.
But I did. I was tripping over it. It wasn't working out. And he just turned the camera around and we shot mine again. And they all sat there off camera and gave me everything. You know what
Amazing,
I mean? It
yeah.
was one of those shoots, and I whatever I needed to clear, I cleared it.
Yeah.
And Matthew was, you got that? That was a great one. I said, yeah, thank you.
That's great.
Thank you to you lot. They were just fantastic.
Yeah.
Just little things like that. That's what that cast was like. That's what that experience was like. It was people just going out to help each other, you know, and be yeah. there for each other.
Yeah.
They could see that I was dipping, and instead of going, oh, Paddy's fucking not what he's cracked up to be.
Yeah.
They all teamed on it, teamed together.
That's brilliant.
And
yeah.
like, come on, yeah, you know, you can do this.
Again, all coming together rather than it being who's trying to outshine who.
Who's trying
to
yeah, do any of that shit.
It's like, right, no, we all, this is, and I guess that's something that, as you said, it was scary. It would have been scary to look at directing that with that many people in.
Yeah.
If that wasn't the attitude. The fact that that was the attitude is probably what made that manageable. The fact that everyone was trying to pull together rather than all of these egos or all of these over-performances to try and balance.
Yeah.
Everyone just going, right, no, we need to
That was
to
the
tell
spirit
this.
Of the film.
Yeah.
And it came through in us. It was wonderful.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I was in the cinema a couple of days ago and I saw a trailer for a new film that you're in, A Child 44. I don't know much about it. I don't know how much you're in it, but I saw the cast of Tom Hardy, Gary Oldman, Charles Dance, Noomi Rapace, Vincent Cassell, and Jason Clarke, who I'm a big fan of from a few TV things he's done.
Yeah.
What is it? And what's the deal with that?
I only met Jason the other week.
I think he's... He was in a TV series, a Chicago cop thing, which he was absolutely stole the show in. And then he was in another film with Tom Hardy a little while back. And yeah, I just think he's got a great look, a great style. He has.
He was in the Planet of the Apes, wasn't he?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, I met him just the other week. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah.
Do you know what, Pip? Honestly, I don't know much about it. We shot
it's
it.
Small, I was going to say, I looked at that cast list and thought there's so many people there because the trailer I saw, I think I literally only I recognised Tom in it. I didn't catch anyone else. And then it was only when I looked it up on IMDb, I was like,
yeah, all these people.
This is good.
It.
But yeah, so I guess it's one of them where it's a smaller role that you kind of.
Yeah, I only worked with Tom and Noomi, really.
Yeah.
The rest of it was working with kids.
Yeah.
I don't know what I can reveal about the film. You know,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. And that's the precarious thing, talking about a film that you haven't
not
seen
yet
because you're like, I don't even know what's in it. I don't know what I shot. And I don't know what's made the
what
cut. There could be hardly anything of me left in it.
That's all good, yeah. It'll just turn into a confusing IMDb list.
Yeah, definitely.
So, was Paddy in that?
I never saw Gary on it.
Yeah.
No, I just saw Tom and Noomi,
yeah.
if I remember. But no, I don't know an awful lot about it. I mean, it's weird when you make films, because then if a film does come out, it's like you're expected to go and talk about it. But with something like that, it was such a long time ago that I'm trying to think back to even what we did or how we shot it or how we made it.
That's amazing. I remember seeing Olivia Colman kind of come in full circle here once on one of the chat shows, and they asked her about, I'm sure it was about Cuban Fury, next one, and it was just out of context. It seemed rude when she was like, I can't really remember.
Olivia?
Yeah.
Doesn't know.
Yeah, just had
no
idea.
She did
like,
it to me.
Like, well, that's fine if it's, you know, you've done these things. And again, if you're not a huge character in it, then you're not going to be seeing edits as it goes along or all sorts
remember?
Of other things. You're just going to have, again, you've
yeah.
said that at the office in that
we
respect.
Did this telly thing together, and it was like she went on one of the shows, Graham Norton, and did the same thing.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, your character. She goes, I don't know. She goes, and what's it about? I don't know. I can't remember. But she kind of does
exactly
get quite nervous around that stuff, Olivia, and she does.
And
I know what she means. Your head goes sometimes. Mm. You're like, I don't know. You know, you go on a slot on television. And people say, oh, you didn't mention this, and this. And I'm like, do you know how quickly that 5 minutes is like 30 seconds?
Yeah. And you know there's a whole line of people who are waiting there to tell you, you forgot to mention this. Yeah. You know, it's like, all right, well.
Well, in Olivia's defence, she might forget shit like that, but she don't forget her lines.
No, that's great. So, I mean, we should start to wrap things up, but I want to talk about Riding the Low a little and about what's ahead. So, yeah, what's going on musically? I know you've been abroad working on new material and recording.
Yeah. We've got a second album coming out, and I just went to Portland to record the vocals on that. I'm working with a guy called Chris Lasarenko, who was in Guided by Voices.
Oh, wow.
They've got this new band now called Eyelids with John Moe and Jonathan Drews, and it's a great band. And I kind of wanted to, when we went in studios here to try and record stuff, we ended up coming out sounding like Oasis and things. And I think that's because we're a guitar band.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to strive for something that was a little bit more kind of, I don't know, yeah, Guided by Voices in a way, or something a little kind of different that wasn't so sort of anchored in the music here.
Yeah,
but so I just started up this kind of collaboration with Chris. But yeah, I went over there and did the vocals, and it's being mixed and all that business, you know, and hopefully we'll have it out before the end of the year. But it's going really well with Riding the Low. We've been on the radio a little bit in the last couple of weeks, and we played with the Charlatans. And
do you enjoy the gigging and touring?
I love it
because it's such a difference from the instant reaction of it. I'd imagine in film and in TV and everything else, it's such a long thing. As you said there, I can't remember that film. I remember acting in it. I'm not sure what happened because it's such a long time until the payoff, essentially. Yeah. Whereas at a show, it's there, it happens, for good and for worse.
Yeah.
You know, if you're shit, it's there instantly. If you're great, it's there instantly, you know?
Yeah, and we've had them where it's been like, God, we started up one gig and literally, I mean, there was a couple of times it's happened, but one gig in particular we started and I saw a load of guys at the back look at each other and go, this is fucking shit, I could work out their mouth.
Wow.
And loads of people just left. Damn. And that was the gig where I learned that there must have been about 20-odd people down the front.
Yeah.
And there was a bunch of people here, they knew all the words.
Yeah.
And I just went, oh, fuck, I'm playing for them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I learned that one real quick. I was like, don't, because before that had bummed me out. We played at some music festival near Brighton and we were on the bill and I got alive to what other acts were on the bill and I was going, listen, man, we're not for your festival.
Yeah.
Trust me, you don't need, no, I really want you to play. And I was talking to the promoter and I was ready to pull us out, but he begged me to play. Literally, it was like, oh, please come, no, it'll mean so much and all the rest of it. So we go on to play after some belly dancers and we literally play the first song and the fucking tent cleared.
Yeah.
Like cleared. People like got up out of protest off their picnic blankets with their fucking hummus and pita breads. And I'm like going, well, don't blame them. You know, they don't want this. We're not that band. We're a rock and roll band. And but it's fun looking back, but it's going
key.
Really,
I mean,
well.
That's a key thing to learn, I think, is that at the end of the day, you've got to put that performance in, particularly at things like festivals. I've done ones before where we've been aware that we're going out and the tent is empty, but we've got to pull people in, and they could come in at any point. We can't kind of go half-hearted into it, because if they peep their head in, if there's no one there and they peep their head in and we're smashing the shit out of this gig to an empty tent, they'll probably come in. They'll probably come and have a look. And it means, the more I remember doing a gig, I can't remember if I've told this on the podcast before, but we got booked to do a gig in a nightclub, which we had a lot of in our early days because there was an electronic element. They didn't realise we're not just a DJ and MC. There's live elements to it. And we did run, and we were on at about 1 or 2 o'clock in this horrible nightclub that was all just drinks promotions and a karaoke room, and also it was horrible. And we started, and there was 6 people there who were there for us and into us.
Yeah.
And the rest were just drunk pricks, just kind of mouthing off and being leery. But really early on, I suddenly went, right, if I was one of them 6 people, I would have probably thrown in the towel about midnight. So before we'd even gone on, I probably would have gone, nah, fuck this place, I ain't doing it.
This.
But that stuck around. So that meant that, in my mind, still stands out as one of, I personally feel, my best performances I've given, because of the guilt almost of them having to sit here through this horrible club night until 1, 2 a.m.
Yeah.
It's like, right, we've got to really give you something now. And, you know, it meant something. But it would have been easy to go, let's just get through this and just churn out any old shit. So
get through it and go home.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's disheartening. But when you turn it around, I mean, that's a beauty. You know, when you actually turn one around and it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
I mean, we love doing that. That's the challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
You go into a new place. But, you know, they don't know our music.
It means all the more. It's easy to go to a crowd that are already cheering your name. And that's not to hate on that at all. But, yeah, it means all the more to get there when there is that tension and that.
Yeah.
And to go, right, I'm going to make you like us.
Yeah. And it's been fascinating, really, because, like, when we... But, you know, and I think there's still, to some degree, you know, people have come to shows and the guys would admit it, and it doesn't ultimately matter, but they would come kind of to see the guy from Dead Man Shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then...
And you're going to have that.
Yeah.
That's kind of unavoidable. That's you know...
And I just thought to myself, well, look, you know, of course they're going to. But what started to happen was that people kept coming back.
Yeah.
And then... more people came back, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're not that interested in. They love the band and they love your music, but they want their photo taken with Chris and Dan, and they want to go.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is great, you know, because they're.
This is meant to be.
Yeah, they're fans of the band. They're not just there to see, you know, the guy from Dead Man Shoes anymore.
Yeah, that's wicked.
But because of that, I suppose the only one of the downsides was that a lot of our earlier gigs, they'd be filmed and stuff. On phones, and they would kind of make it onto YouTube, and that they sounded like shit.
It's filmed on a phone,
you know.
It's going to sound like shit. It's kind of tough, isn't it?
And you would go like,
"Please don't share that."
Oh, please! We actually got to one guy. I said, "Please, could you take them down?" And you know, if ever we needed them to put together something, you know, we'd call on your footage and said, "But people." I get in the wrong idea because, and we were like anything, like I said earlier, we were kind of inventing ourselves. We were doing our apprenticeship, and I remember there was some. I think it was The Quietest did this thing about actors in bands, and it was me and Reese Ifans, and they were kind of ripped him and ripped me, and were like called the band Pub Rock and all the rest of it. And it was like, well, we played pubs, you know. We wanted to learn. Our craft, and then the video that they had was from our second ever gig, you know, and it was like, this is bullshit, you know, this is, that was from years ago, we don't even play like that anymore, so thank God for people like Tim Burgess, who were kind of, come and play Festival Number 6, and come and support the Charlatans, and we were ready.
Yeah, that's amazing.
We were ready, we'd done our years, and we're still learning, and that's the great thing. Every so many months, you'll kind of go up another level, and you know, things will kick
in.
Putting
in the hours, it's putting in the hours again, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's all getting there. So, I mean, we'll wrap things up now. Just quickly, what's ahead? What's your main focus going forward?
Well, I've written a screenplay called The Journeyman, and it's about a boxer.
Yeah,
and it's a beautiful kind of story. And he's basically in a title fight, like an area title fight, and he gets injured. He gets a brain injury.
Yeah.
And so it's about kind of his life coming to terms with being in a new body, waking up and almost being like in a different shell. And it's a beautiful story, and it's been in my mind for some years now, and so that looks like the next thing that I'll direct.
Great. It's fascinating, the kind of the world of boxing, in that way that you can be, you know, the heavyweight champ and the most famous person in the world. You can be Mike Tyson, you can be Ali, but there's obviously a lot of different divisions and different championships. You can be champ and walk down the street and no one knows your name, or be champ and not be earning a great pay packet, you know, be one of the best in the world. You know, it's so hard to decide the best in the world because of all the belts now, but you're definitely in there, in the mix, as one of the best in the world. And you could be still working in a factory, or still, you know, doing whatever is needed to pay the bills. So that sounds like a fascinating, and again, the same with a lot of people talk about in football and most sports, that if you're in anything that's based largely on physicality,
yeah,
you know, when that, if that rug's pulled from under you,
Where do you go?
What do you do? Where do you go? What can you, you know, how do you adjust to life in the real world?
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, well, it's looking like we'll be making it later this year, so...
Amazing.
I'll be in production with Dad. So that's the main sort of focus, really.
Excellent. Well, we'll keep an eye out for all of that. I think I've taken up enough of your time now, so...
Hey, no worries, Pip.
Thank you very much for coming on and chatting. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers, mate. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
That was Distraction Pieces podcast episode 29 with Mr. Paddy Considine. How lovely is that dude? You may have noticed me nerding out and geeking out slightly there about how much I wanted to talk to him about and pick his brains about and inquire. We could have, again, it's another one, we could have done two podcasts, I think, but that's that for now. Thank you very much for listening. You can find me at Scroobius Pipio. Really appreciate it if you subscribe, because that really helps. I've mentioned this quite often. It's a way that you can help support the podcast and not spend a penny. Basically, if you subscribe and hopefully set it to automatic download, then it just really, it sets us up nicely so that each time a podcast goes up, we get a lot of downloads at once that climbs us up in the charts and increases our exposure. But another thing you can do is just tell people about it. I get a lot of tweets from people who say, I wasn't previously into podcasts, or I don't normally listen to podcasts, and they seem to be into this one. So if you could spread the word, that's amazing. Imagine if, you know, me saying that, you probably go, I'm not going to bother, it doesn't make a difference. But imagine if each of you got one extra person to listen. That's quite obvious and simple, but that doubles our listenership in a week. If you all get one extra person listening. If you get two or three, crazy. So yeah, anyway, try doing that. It'd be nice if you support in that manner. We will be back next week. It's one a week now. It's not two a week. It's not March anymore. But thank you very much for supporting and listening. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.